This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Welcome to the Annenberg Performance Space at KCRW headquarters in our town hall. Take me to your dealer, a KCRW joint. It has been 2 years since recreational pot became legal in California and more than 2 decades since voters approved medical marijuana. And since then, dozens of other states and Washington, D.C. have legalized either medical or recreational use of the drug. That shift, by the way, in legal status is also driving a huge shift in people's attitudes. This is how Hollywood has represented pot over the years.
Is that a joint, man? God damn, looks like a quarter pounder, man.
George Tote Weed. Man.
Absolutely George Tote Weed. Are you kidding me, man? He grew fields of that stuff, yeah. Man. That's what I'm talking about.
I'm hungry. We should cook up some sausages. Do we have any sausages? What do you mean by that? No. Why do you guys hate me?
Weed, man. We'll sell weed.
Man, you can't up and decide to sell weed. You gotta know people to plug you into that kind of thing.
I do.
Who you know?
You, yo!
There you go. You got it. Nice. Good, huh?
Good job.
Yeah.
Take pride in that.
But now the old image and stigma of stoner culture is being turned on its head. Venture capitalists are all over the cannabis industry. West Hollywood recently opened its first cannabis cafe, complete with bud tenders and weed sommeliers. Chefs are specializing in multi-course weed pairings in private homes and supper clubs. You can go on high-end cannabis retreats. And California is now the biggest cannabis market in the world. But the transition from illegal drug to a legal industry has been and continues to be pretty rocky. Tonight, we're going to talk to some folks who are deeply engaged with the industry. We're going to hear about their personal experiences and get their take on where things are and where things are going. Let's start the conversation with Abdullah Saeed. He's a cannabis journalist and podcaster. You may have heard a couple of his stories on Greater LA. Abdullah, welcome.
How's it going, Steve?
I want to talk a little bit about the idea of stoner culture because you just heard, you know, all those clips from movies and Spicoli and Dave Chappelle and everybody else. I mean, a lot of it, I would think, has changed. A lot of folks from my generation, you know, I'm still in my 30s, still think of the stoner as like Spicoli, Jeff Spicoli from Fast Times at Ridgemont High, right. Cheech and Chong, Up in Smoke. Remember the van that was covered in grass?
Yeah, these are all films that I've watched and loved my entire life.
And you're a young guy, I mean, but you've probably seen a lot of changes just even in your lifetime.
Yeah, absolutely. Things have changed a lot. I mean, you know, I've always been a very cannabis enthusiastic person, you know, ever since I was a teenager. You know, in high school, I was definitely seen as the stoner kid, but I don't think anybody, you know, foresaw that I would turn it into my profession. And, you know, so I'm kind of like vindicated for a lifetime of smoking weed in some ways.
Really,
you know,
vindicated.
What I mean? Yeah, in some ways. But, you know, I definitely identify with some of those portrayals. I think that, you know, in some ways, those can be seen as kind of like one note, not necessarily negative, but not representative of the actual breadth of who's out there smoking weed, because it's a lot of people. It's people of all ages, people of all races, economic backgrounds. It's not just the Spicolis and the...
That's always been the case, though, right?
Yeah, that has always been the case. Absolutely. A huge variety of people in many different societies throughout history have indulged in cannabis at various levels.
You did a story for us on Greater LA about these so-called pot seshes. These are underground farmers markets, as it were, for all kinds of cannabis products. For people who perhaps didn't catch that story, tell us briefly about what goes on at these places.
All right. So essentially, almost any night of the week in Los Angeles and in a lot of places throughout California, you can go to an unlicensed farmers market for cannabis where people are selling cannabis, right, direct to consumer. And a lot of those consumers are people who are used to consuming a large amount of cannabis, right, a fair amount of cannabis. And now that the price of cannabis has gone up so much for consumers, right, they have no choice but to turn to an unlicensed market, right? The dispensaries are simply too expensive. And there's a lot of growers who were growing weed under Prop 215, under California medical cannabis, who once Prop 64 passed, weren't able to attain a license And, you know, it's pretty hard to suddenly completely change your whole way of life. So they have to opt to sell unlicensed weed at an unlicensed market. But, of course, luckily for them, there's lots of people who have been priced out of legal cannabis in California who are there ready to buy their weed.
I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the fact that the price of marijuana has gone up so much that there's a big difference between illegal and legal weed here in California. But I want to also bring into the conversation Brett Feldman, co-founder, president of the cannabis brand Wonder Brett. He grows cannabis on his farm in Long Beach. He's set to open a licensed dispensary in the Fairfax District on July 4th.
Yep.
We You're hope quite to a open patriot, up aren't you?
Yeah, I love America.
Tell me how long you've been selling pot.
About 23 years, more than half my life.
And you want to do that legally now?
I've been doing it legally
you
for
have
a while.
Been. With your farm?
Yeah, we've been licensed for about a year and a half now in the recreational market. We were previously in the Prop 215 era, where we had a cooperative collective. We always had a vision to build a very classy brand. I like to think that I'm selling experience more than I'm selling weed.
Prop 215, by the way, was medical marijuana, right? Back in 1996, that was approved.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So with that being said, it's a totally different landscape now that the way that things are regulated and taxed doesn't really make a lot of sense, just face value of what's going on. Would you make something legal from the black market and bring it into the recreational market? It should be cheaper is what everybody thinks. But now it's more expensive than the black market. So it's not any type of surprise that this is what's going on when you look at where people are going to get product. I don't think the California voter voted for this. I think they voted for legal cannabis to keep their friends and family from going to jail. And they voted for a clean, regulated market cannabis space so they could trust the market. The product they were getting was going to be safe. And by what's going on in the state, the way it's structured, this is the only way it could unfold because it's so poorly thought out. Like, they didn't have people like myself or Asia in the conversation when all these regulations were written. So they just have overtaxed and overregulated us to a place where it doesn't make sense. When an ounce of alcohol is about 2 cents for tax, and an ounce of marijuana is $9.25, and that's just on the base level before you, the consumer, go into the store and then pay another 37% tax on the top of it of an excise tax, which is obscenely high when most cannabis businesses run at about a 20% profit margin. So if you think about in the state of California, who's actually making any money? It's the only people really making money is the state of California. And that's why you have so many cannabis businesses in California going broke and going bankrupt right now, because they've completely taxed it into a place where it makes no sense.
We're going to talk about that coming up in the next segment.
Sorry about that.
No, you're fine. I just, you mentioned, you know, the fact that people voted for it because they didn't want to see their friends and families go to jail, get arrested. You were arrested back in 2006.
Yeah, I was. And that is why I qualified for the social equity program in Los Angeles. And I was very fortunate to be one of the few people, one of the 100, to get awarded a license in the last round.
How'd you learn? So here you are. You said you've been selling it for a long time, even before, since the, this was during 1996, right after the medicinal marijuana prop passed. Where did you get your business know-how?
I have to give it to my parents. They built a family catering company. I worked with them since I was 7 years old, counting forts and napkins and then working on the slicing machine and then doing the books for them. So they gave me a very entrepreneurial background. Once I got introduced to cannabis and saw how much I loved it and how I felt, you know, I dreamt about it being legal one day. I dreamt about what it would do to the world and how it changes people, how it really, cannabis breeds compassion more than anything I've ever seen on this planet. It brings people together. And I think it's part of my goal in life to change the world in some way. And I think through cannabis is how I want to do that. And I think the more we talk about cannabis, the more the culture will change, and that's how you effectively change anything, is by talking about it enough to where it changes the perceptions and all these stigmas and the ridiculous over-regulation and taxation.
Khadija Allen Asia, she is a budding pot entrepreneur hoping to open a cannabis club in partnership with a group called Fourth Movement. They're a social equity program working to make the cannabis industry more diverse and equitable. Welcome, Asia.
Thank you. Hi.
You're from the Leimert Park area, South LA.
I am, Crenshaw District.
Talk a little bit about how drugs and the war on drugs affected your life growing up.
Well, I would have to say it affected my family, my parents, more than anything, and it kind of trickled down to me. A lot of my friends went to jail for drug-related offenses, you know, things of that nature, you know, when I honestly feel like, you know, it's completely unfair for them to go to jail and, you know, have this jacket on when it's now legal, you know what I mean? So as far as that goes, and then, you know, people are just trying to make a living. You know, at the end of the day, I don't feel like people are stealing to get high on marijuana. You know what I mean? I don't feel like anybody's getting hurt to get high on marijuana. So, like I said, for me, it was just, I saw a lot of my friends and my family being arrested for these things. It definitely showed me what I, you know, the road that I didn't want to go down. So it kind of deterred me from my passion for cannabis. And then when this opportunity was arisen, you know, for me to join such a powerful, you know, movement with Fourth Movement and everything, I was able to get on track with, you know, some of my passion and some of the stuff that I wanted to do with life, with which definitely involved cannabis.
I also want to bring in Hillary Bricken, our fourth guest. She's an attorney who specializes in the weed business. Obviously, the complicated regulations that go along with it. Hillary, I assume you didn't start out focusing on cannabis law.
No, I did not.
It wasn't your first forte. How did you end up with that specialty? And have you experienced any kind of stigma in the profession because of the kind of work that you do?
Well, I'll be perfectly honest. As an attorney, this was not something I ever endeavored to do.
So you're like Abdullah. I never thought, right?
Correct. Yeah. What my law firm is really good at is occupying and becoming an authority in emerging markets. We don't just do cannabis. We do a lot of scary areas that are high risk, lots of ambiguity, unpredictability, and volatility. So cannabis was a natural growth area for us, and what ended up happening was that a criminal defense attorney in Washington State basically brought us his book, because Washington State, very similar to California and the Compassionate Use Act, Prop 215, with the collective model. A lot of white-collar business lawyers did not want to touch it. Why? Because of federal illegality and the fact that we have to follow all of these ethical rules and the legal implications of us aiding and abetting and conspiring to violate federal law by helping our clients kept a lot of people at bay. So as a young, very dumb, very broke, nothing to lose associate, I dove right in to the Democratic experiment in Washington State.
It's still a Schedule I drug federally.
100%. And yeah. I take the risk every day that a zealous U.S. prosecutor will not pursue me as a consigliere to my clients who are still drug dealers as far as the feds are concerned.
We're going to get into more of the details about the pot business, obviously. Take a quick break. Coming up, getting into the business of weed and L.A.'s social equity program. You're listening to Greater L.A. on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. You're listening to our town hall, Take Me to Your Dealer, a KCRW joint. And Hillary Bricken, we left off with you. I want to come back to you because legal cannabis sales in California last year are estimated, I'm just floored by this number, $3 billion. This is legal cannabis sales. The illegal market is like three times that amount of money. So the illegal market is still just burgeoning. We've heard that high taxes on legal cannabis and the regulatory hurdles for becoming a licensed seller have a lot to do with that. You guys have talked about it on this panel. If I decided tonight, Hillary, that this sounds like a great business opportunity, do me a favor and paint a quick picture for us of what it would take for me to get this license to operate.
Well, first of all, you need to come to Jesus, because the evil VCs and PE money that's in the space, that is who you're going to access to raise funds to build your cannabis infrastructure. One of the biggest problems that California has is local control. Why? Because Prop 64 and MAL-CRSA, the Medicinal Adult Use Cannabis Regulation and Safety Act, they're combined now, basically stuck with the liquor model. You have to get through the locals in order to get your state license, and all 482 cities and 58 counties have a different regime. So getting through West Hollywood compared to getting through Long Beach, very, very different price tag. And then you need to realize you are not going to get any equity or fair treatment from the federal government, so your federal income tax rate's going to hover at about 80%.
80?
And you're, yes.
80.
Yes. The Internal Revenue Code 280E folks, you do not get to take tax deductions. You get cost of goods sold. So if you're a distributor or a retailer and you don't make anything, you're just a trafficker, you are paying very, very high amounts in tax. Plus, the kicker, you cannot get a bank account and you will be working in all cash. So cannabis is a logistical nightmare. I'll echo Brett. Not anybody who has a license is really rolling in dough, but who is? It's the people selling the pickaxes and the shovels, right? Gold rush mentality. Technology people, equipment, hardware, real estate, very hot area. But actual licensees, if they want to survive, they really need to hang on, because it's going to get worse before it gets better with the regulatory red tape and barriers to entry.
Quickly, Brett and Asia, did you guys know this 80% number?
No.
No.
Yes.
You did.
Unfortunately, it's true.
Abdullah was just shaking his head. Did you know this 80% number?
I did not, actually.
You're floored right now.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. And I mean, I definitely know that there's a lot of obstacles to being profitable in this business. When you go into a dispensary and you see like the big brands, the ones that you see everywhere, I mean, there's not that many people that are just making money hand over fist, despite the stigma that, you know, there's some sort of green rush going on. There's actually a lot of obstacles to actually being profitable.
I want to talk, and again, we'll talk about the business model. That's what this segment is about. But the war on drugs that we kind of touched on with Asia and with Brett, wealthy and middle-class Americans typically went largely untouched. The police weren't spending a whole lot of time in Beverly Hills or Santa Monica arresting doctors or lawyers or their children who were smoking a little pot. It was people like Asia's family and friends, people in poorer minority neighborhoods who went to prison for minor offenses. LA now has something called the Social Equity Program, SEP. Tell us a little bit about, Hillary, how that works, or maybe how it doesn't work.
So part of the beauty of these democratic experiments and the fact that the feds have really butted out for all intents and purposes is that we get to try new things. And part of MAL-CRSA and Prop 64 really is social justice. And LA, with a handful of other cities in California, have taken it upon themselves. The state has not done anything in this realm, except maybe fund it, to help assuage the issues that have been caused by the war on drugs. The issue in Los Angeles is that not just anybody qualifies for this program. You have to meet relatively high qualifications, detrimental qualifications, to even participate. That has been met and exceeded. One of the problems, though, is that there's very hawkish, predatory behavior around investors, management companies, and all of these power brokers on the side that have political aspirations. And eventually, some of them want these social equity businesses to fail so that they can snap them up. There's also the concept, and social equity participants, you know, they would probably cop to this. They were selling their status, right, to the highest bidder. They don't really want to run these businesses. They don't really want to compete. But you've got some power broker, institutional Wall Street firm that's behind them, really kind of puppeteering them. So it's an imperfect system. It has really, really noble intentions. But in reality, it is very difficult to pull off.
What about you, Abdullah? How much a part of a person's past do you think contributes to whether someone gets one of these licenses?
Well, I think that the SEP, the social equity program, is a noble effort, right? You would hope that when there's a line of people to cash in on legal cannabis, the people at the front of that line would be the ones who were most marginalized by cannabis prohibition, right? And it's rare to see an effort like that in America. So I definitely like applaud the intentions behind that. But I think that, you know, when you look into it, the same people who are supposed to be helped by that program are actually ending up spending way more money on the legal assistance that they might need, spending money on rent, you know, to hold a property while they're waiting for their license to come through, and it ends up hurting them, right? Because it's a slow process, and it doesn't necessarily work that well. You know, I don't think you can look to any individual government agency and expect them to just solve this entire history that's really screwed up with a single program that's going to give people licenses. But I think that it's very painful to see that in the legalization age, how long it seems it's really going to take to get to a place where there is some justice in this respect, you know? And I think that's very discouraging to a lot of people. You know, if you look at the state of California or any other state that's legalized recreational cannabis, they haven't done it because there was too many people in jail for a nonviolent crime. They did it because they wanted money. That's why they put a 25% sales tax on cannabis, right? That's why you tax the hell out of anything.
So you don't think it was the state of California saying, oh, we really want these people who have suffered under these, you know, draconian laws to be able to sell weed? You think it's California seeing dollar signs?
I think so. And I think in the city of L.A., of course, the SCP is evidence of some, you know, effort for social justice here. But it's not enough when, you know, the motivation, largely speaking, is just like, okay, let's make a lot of money off this. That's why they start doing those projections. You know what I mean? They'll be like, oh, we're going to make $6 billion in tax revenue next year. They're ignoring the fact that these markets have existed for a long time, completely outside the system. And if you make the system unfriendly to the people buying the most weed, it's just not going to work.
Brett, you've been obviously trying to get this off the ground. You've been selling it for a while as a farmer, but now wanting a dispensary as well. Does any of this ring true in what the panel is talking about as far as getting licensure?
100%. It's a chaotic system. It doesn't make a lot of sense. They broke all the licenses out into 6-7 different licenses. And the only way to kind of survive is to have every one of those licenses put together into a full vertical type platform for your business model. And if you don't, then you're kind of just going to be chasing your tail, and you're going to be getting taken advantage of by all these third-party business out there that are just really taking all the margin from anything that was there, your margin.
Asia, does it make you rethink wanting to do this?
Absolutely not. I can do this. We can do this. Yeah, no,
but it sounds pretty scary, right? I mean,
it does. I mean, but it has to happen. You know what I mean? It just means for us as retailers that we really have to make sure that we're, you know, doing our job.
Brett, how's your company doing now?
Actually, we are doing phenomenal right now. We're kind of one of the outliers. That's where everyone else is kind of going down. We're going up. But we have a very different business model. We kind of hold true to our core values of how we got here for the past 20 years and follow those same exact philosophies. Whereas a lot of people come into this space with big capital from out of country or wherever it is, and they think that they're just going to grab this thing by the horns and run with it and show all these dumb stoners how to do this. But they don't realize that it's a very team effort in every group that gets anything done. And you need to have a great team, and you have to have the ability to build great teams to survive in this space right now. Tons of brands that are going to fail this year. Big brands that you think that are like, oh, these guys are no way, but they're going away for sure.
Big brands like the pot sellers.
Yeah, pot sellers, storefronts, distribution companies, packaging companies, manufacturing labs that all raced out to go buy a bunch of equipment to make vape pens or concentrate, but didn't have any ability to do sell-through. You can make as much product as you want, but when there's only 600 stores in the whole state of California, there's just not that many doors to go sell this product to. So it's a restricted, finite market that has been kind of strangled, and I think it's due to unseen forces, you know, from other industries that don't want to see this evolve fast. They want to see the taxation stay high. They want to see distressed assets so that we built this infrastructure and then the big money comes in and buys it all for pennies on the dollars from us. And then miraculously, I'm pretty sure taxes are going to drop by 80%.
Asia, I'll ask you again. You said this doesn't scare you. But you're going to be selling pot recreationally, legally, in an era where there's still illegal shops, illegal, you know, seshes is a bill reported on, where you can get it a lot cheaper. So if you have these high taxes that you have to place on your product and the other illegal dispensaries, you know, places don't have to do that, doesn't it concern you that maybe you're not going to sell as much as the other guy?
I mean, for sure. It raises a flag, but I mean, you expect the government to do their job and you know, shut these illegal doors down, you know what I mean? And that'll drive traffic to our stores. So, I mean, for me, like I said, it's we just really have to make sure that we're doing our jobs as retailers, selling an experience, keeping the life after the sale alive, you know, just things like that, rather than just, you know, because you go to these underground dispensaries, and there's no product knowledge behind these things. You know, there's just a number of things that we plan on incorporating into our brand, aside from just walking up to the counter and saying, hey, I want this. You know what I mean?
So what are you going to do differently that maybe a MedMen isn't going to do?
Yeah, for sure, just selling a full-on experience, giving the product knowledge, you know, really giving that one-on-one time. You have, you know, you have your employees, and a part of their job is going to be to deliver the product knowledge to these customers. You have people that come in and don't know anything about cannabis, you know, and, you know, they may have pain, they may have anxiety, depression, insomnia, can't eat, you know, so you come to, you know, my store, I expect for my staff to be able to educate you on everything, you know, in the spectrum, in the realm of, you know, whatever it is that you're looking for. You know what I mean? So just really, really selling experience.
Has the city given you any idea of when you're going to get a license?
No.
No clue.
You know, it's just a lot of stuff going on with that. You know, there's just been a lot of setbacks, but it's coming. It's coming. I have a date where we plan on, you know, starting some construction on my store. So hopefully, you know, soon, you know, next after that, my license will be on the way.
Where's the store going to be? Lamar Park?
No. I wish. It's actually going to be on La Cienega, right? Okay. Yeah, right near the Kaiser.
Oh, okay.
Off the 10 all freeway.
Right,
so
right near Fairfax and all that.
Exactly. Yeah. So prime location. I have no doubt that we'll be able to deliver.
Hillary, you talked about the local control. A lot of cities and counties across the state that don't allow any pot sales, which seems anathema to what the state has tried to do, right? They do have the right to decide whether to allow it or not. But talk about that situation and what it means for the industry and that sort of, it sounds very hodgepodge.
It is. First of all, we have the state versus federal conflict, which has pretty much cooled off, right? And the federal government for many years gave us enforcement priorities on the backs of which states formulated their entire licensing regimes. What has held consistently in every state is that cities and counties have a say because they have police power to protect us, right? Our health and our safety. So even if you have a city or a county in California where a majority of the voters voted in favor of Prop 64, a board of commissioners or a city council can still decide for you that it's not going to be in your backyard. And there's a lot of NIMBY power, a lot of political influence, private interest groups that work very hard to keep cannabis outside of their borders. So even today, the majority of California cities and counties do not allow for commercial cannabis activity activity at all. It is still illegal within their borders, and it completely undermines the success of the democratic experiment, because guess what? Illegal drug dealing is already going on in their backyards, but they will not get on board with transparent licensed cannabis, and they have every right to do that.
I think one thing that's been mentioned, I want to make this clear, because people who are applying for licenses have to already have a place to sell, so they're already having to pay rent. All those things have to be in place for them to do this, right?
Generally correct. Depending on the municipality, the barriers to entry can be insanely high. A lot of them, to ensure that the right players are getting in, revolves around demonstration of a right to real property. Some of them have liquidity requirements. Right now in the city of Sonoma, you have to have at least a 3-year projection with a budget to support whatever your build out and your inventory is going
to
look like.
You have to have this money in pocket, like
in
cash.
The bank, people. In the bank. They need to know that you're good for it. And a lot of people, what they do to substantiate the funds, they are going to hard money lenders. They're going to venture capitalists, private equity firms, friends and family. They are scraping it together to try to win. And the thing in Sonoma, this is the kicker, only one retail license. Hundreds of people will apply for this license. They each will pay at least an $11,000 non-refundable license application fee. So Sonoma's going to get fat immediately just off application fees, and that is becoming the norm in the retail sector.
One license they're giving out.
One single license for a brick-and-mortar storefront, one delivery-only license, that is it.
In wine country.
In wine country. Who wouldn't want the opportunity?
Are you working with people going through the process? I mean, how is it working out for them? Not in Sonoma, but here in greater LA.
Oh, I've worked with people that pursued licensure in Culver City, West Hollywood, Linwood, El Monte.
Are they giving up?
Most of them lose. Most of them fail. They will dump hundreds of thousands of dollars into these competitive licensing applications just for a shot. And I'm telling you now, if you don't have a lobbyist, government relations person, you're not getting your foot in the door. It is just the nature of the game. So many of them fail. The ones that have won have not only invested hundreds of thousands of dollars in the application process, but have promised millions of dollars to the city in revenue and community benefit funds, and of course, monetary contributions to strategic partners in the city.
Is it like this in Colorado or Washington State?
No, those states were more egalitarian because they created that initial roadmap. They wanted the experiment to work. They wanted to show the federal government they could be in control. But this trend of competitive licensing with high barriers to entry, insane amounts of capitalization, is something that's really come about probably in the last 5 years.
Capitalization sounds like capitalism.
Well, here's the thing with legalization. While it breeds normalization, it also attracts corporatization because we want to make it turnkey like other industries. That's what regulators really want. They don't want to be bothered with your issues and your struggles. They want policing to be very simple. And on the backs of those federal enforcement priorities, even that creates a certain kind of candidate that can play in the space and survive.
You're working, Asia, with the Fourth Movement, this group, right? Trying to get your store up and running.
Yes.
On La Cienega. Are they bankrolling this process? Are they spending hundreds of thousands of dollars to do this?
Yes.
Do they have lobbyists?
Yes.
I mean, one of the questions that I have when we're talking about, you know, the alcohol industry and other industries in California is like, what kind of lobby mechanism is in Sacramento for something like this, Hillary?
It is deep and it is dark. I am promising you all, this is business as usual in America. It took 30 seconds. When those regulations were being drafted, multiple private interest groups with varying degrees of cash had seats at the table to ensure that certain rules got passed. For example, in Malcursa, they limit one license type, right? And that's a type 3. It's the largest cultivation license you can have. It's 22,000 square feet indoor up to an acre outdoor. It's a medium license. So CDFA, California Department of Food and Ag, that oversees cultivators, said, okay, everybody, you can only have one because we don't want mega grows coming in. At the same time...
Is that what we call the big guys? Big pot?
Big-ish, right? Until 2023. At the same time, they left the door open for cultivators to get multiple type 1 and type 2 licenses that they stack at the same real property. I have a client. I'm very proud of them right now. They have 150 acres undergrowth, full canopy in Santa Barbara County. And it's all different little license types. So somebody lobbied for that, to keep that the status quo, right?
How many acres do you have, Brett, in Long Beach?
I'm an indoor cultivator, so it's a little bit different. The outdoor licenses are by acres and stuff like that. I have a 22,000 square foot indoor facility in Long Beach. It's a very large scale indoor operation. We house 30,000 plants daily.
30,000 plants.
Yeah, we harvest every other day. So we are cutting clones every day. We are harvesting every other day. We are refilling rooms every other day. We are trimming every day. It is a nonstop machine that is relentless. There's no room for error or stopping at any point. Once you start that train, there is no stopping it. If you stop it, it costs millions of dollars, and no one wants you to stop it once you start it.
Do you have a lobbyist?
No.
Do you want a lobbyist?
I'd prefer
anybody
not
here a
to.
Lobbyist?
I've been a cultivator and a provider of cannabis in for so many years that I've lived kind of as a hermit. I didn't really share what I've done with a lot of people. It's not something that is used to my DNA having to come up and even talk about this, but talking about it is what needs to happen. Like, we need to talk about this. People need to talk about cannabis all the time till people are tired of you talking about cannabis. Because the only way we are going to change society's view of cannabis, which is basically the word for culture, is culture controls everything. And when we can get everybody's opinion to change about how we view this, the stigmas, all these aspects, that will reflect in real change. When you talked about vegan food 20 years ago, people thought you were crazy. Now you can't go anywhere without a whole vegan restaurant, and it's completely normal. That's the cultural shift of conversation and just talking about it, illuminating the topic to the place of where people don't control this conversation and take it away from us, because the conversation that's been out there is the wrong conversation. It's about all the negative things instead of the great benefits that we all get from this. And there are true, quantifiable, great benefits. People with epilepsy, cancer, AIDS patients. Life is hard. Some people just need cannabis and not alcohol.
You guys obviously are the legal operations on the panel. I want to talk for a moment with Abdullah again about how these seshes, the illegal operations, these underground farmers markets, how they're handled and whether the police are busting any of these. Like, you know, if you're an illegal seller and you see all these obstacles in your way, why would you want to go through all of that when you can, you know, if the risk is being arrested by the cops? Are the cops doing anything about this?
Well, you know, I don't think that it's a really high priority for the police. You know, at most of these events, there's not really any serious, like, violent crime or robberies happening. It's kind of just an organization of like-minded people, right?
But we've seen some arrests of unlicensed places.
Yeah, certainly. They happen all the time. I mean, it is, you know, if the police catches wind of an unlicensed dispensary or a sesh going on, I mean, they'll probably do something. Brett, do you have experience with that?
Yeah, seshes get raided when they get to be too big. Normally, then somebody notices what's going on at that location, complains, and somebody does it. But the cops don't actively go out trying to search for these things, and nor do they really want to, because getting caught with, you know, even a small amount of marijuana or a large sum of marijuana is just a misdemeanor. So it's really been, all the teeth has been taken out of the purpose for it. But there is a whole second wave on the war on drugs that is coming when we talk about, oh, we're going to not go after people for marijuana and legalize it. Well, because the way they legalized it and created all these regulations and all these taxes, you have all these very resourceful stoners that have been surviving for years, coming out of the closet, going and trying to get it into the system, then getting completely smashed and destroyed by the system because of the way it was designed, forcing them to go back to their old ways, and then the cops are now going to come back and get them again.
Yeah,
it's just this really weird cycle of starting the war on drugs over again at a new level that is It's like, we made this legal, right? So why are we still getting treated like criminals every single day for this? Why, when I had an inspection today, did they come with bulletproof vests on to come look at marijuana plants? We have over 100 employees in there. We're, you know, we're doing everything to the letter of the law, but yet we're still getting treated like everything we do, we're doing something illegal, or we're trying to cheat the system at any aspect that we can. And we're, all we're really trying to do is just do something legal and good with this plant, you know?
Hillary, to what they're saying about, you know, what's going on in the legal market, is it a problem that the illegal market, as far as enforcement goes, does it make it harder for the legal market to get up and running when you've got so many people, when it's so lax? But then the cops are, you know, the police are looking at, like, your shop, which is what you're trying to make sure is going to the letter of the law.
Yeah, they come after the legal grows because that's where assets can be taken. There's you know, real stuff there. There's property.
There's more money.
Yeah, there's money. I mean, and they'll just take it and then say, come try and get it from us later. It's like, it's on you to try and prove that you're innocent after the fact of doing all this. So,
so Hillary, does it make it any harder?
It does. It really does. You know, the biggest difference between the legal market and the illegal market when it comes to product is quality. The vaping epidemic is a really good example of why the licensed market is superior. Here's the problem, though. You're not going to be able to find an illegal maker of products to sue them for products liability, and they sure as hell aren't going to have insurance to pay for your bills. They are untouchable. They move. They are shifty, fly by night. It's a very difficult problem to drill down on. And I don't envy any regulator that's trying to do that. And California has a tremendous problem because it's so large and it's been normalized since 1996. The state should really be incentivizing people's participation in the licensed market, but they have not done a very good job of that because of the barriers to entry and the overall lack of meaningful enforcement.
So if you're a consumer, you want to buy from a legal shop, obviously. Because the protections are there. But
correct.
Also, I mean, I think of, you know, how I used to buy marijuana when I was 18 years old.
Sure.
You know, and it wasn't from a legal shop in Alabama. It was, you know what I'm saying?
Well,
so it's like,
I
never had any problem, by the way, with it back then.
So. Part of the democratic experiment is this bet that consumers and the consumer psychology is going to follow every other commodity in this country, where we care about ingredients, we care about what we're putting into our bodies, we want to know where our ingestible items come from. And I do think that that's starting to catch with cannabis, because we are starting to really see a lot of product innovation, and we're starting to see microdosing and other quality control, really kind of awesome technique that people are beginning to care about. And that's all coming from the legal market. So I think it's a good bet, but it's a long bet.
Yeah, but, you know, I got to add, though, that, you know, those trends tend to be followed by people who are not as avid consumers of cannabis, right? So we're talking about the fact that 80% of the cannabis that's bought is bought by 20% of the people, right? That, like, smaller group of very dedicated consumers, right? There's a lot of people that might buy an eighth of weed, and, you know, they want to know all the ingredients and whatever, so they go to a dispensary, and then that eighth sits, you know, in a drawer in their coffee table for like a month, right? Whereas there's a person who's going to be smoking an eighth or a quarter every single day of their life, right? And they...
That's a lot of pot.
Well, by your standards, you know what? That's a very subjective statement. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
No, it is.
Yeah, like...
I certainly know people like that.
Yeah, there's some people... There's veterans who have PTSD who might consume, like, you know, multiple grams of cannabis concentrate a day. Yeah. You know, that's the thing about cannabis. It's not going to kill you. So, you know, you can go through the process of figuring out what's going to work for you in what way, right? Now, those people are the ones buying the cannabis, right? And you can send the cops out and you can shut down all their dispensaries and you can say, oh, all their weed's got pesticides and poisons and little spiders in it or whatever you want to say, right? But at the end of the day, the avid cannabis consumer is a lot smarter than anyone gives them credit for. They know what they want. They trust their nose. They trust their taste buds because they've had to do that for decades already. They develop their cannabis consumption habit under Prop 215 when weed was actually freely available in the amounts that people needed it and it was still affordable, right? So you can keep doing it, but you know what? The proof is in the pudding. They raise the price of weed, There's only 400, 600 dispensaries in the whole state. The black market is back. It will always come back.
We're going to take a quick... Did you say spiders, by the way? So, anyway.
Yeah, that's a thing.
We're going to take a quick break. Maybe we'll get into that coming up. Also coming up, the future of the cannabis industry. You're listening to a special edition of Greater LA on KCRW. Special town hall edition of Greater LA. Take me to your dealer, a KCRW joint. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Hillary Bricken, let me come back to you again because we've obviously been gaining a lot of knowledge from you. There's been a lot of hype about the pot business in California, but last year, and we alluded to this earlier in the program, we saw some pretty bad things happening to the legal dispensaries. Big layoffs at MedMen, also at Weedmaps, the site that a lot of people go to for information about where to get pot. We saw some company stock prices take a tumble. So how would you characterize this moment in time in California's pot industry?
I am not going to lie. This is exactly what's supposed to be happening. I've been in other states where the Democratic experiment has run through cycles. It's just taking longer in California for things to stabilize. It's taking longer for cities to buy into the Democratic experiment. The difference here, though, from other states, was that immediately out of the gate, big money was at the door and ready to change the face of the industry.
They knew what was coming.
Absolutely, because by that point, you had multi-state operators that had gained licensing in super competitive jurisdictions that have raised a ton of money. They see California as the crown jewel for multiple different reasons. So in the future, we are probably going to see massive failure. I agree with Brett that is right around the corner. We're peaking right with that initial licensure and that rush to get licensed. And we're going to see a huge amount of consolidation as people merge, as the assets become distressed in the secondary market. Big buyers are going to come in, buy those at a discount, and then we're going to start to see something, honestly, that looks like a franchise model. Even though that's controlled by federal law, these are the folks who are going to try to be legacy operators because their goal at the end of the day is not necessarily to compete. They want to gather as many licensed operations as possible because when it is legalized federally, they want a huge exit with folks like Philip Morris, CVS, Big Pharma, Whole Foods, they are not looking to play around in these little tiny markets. It's
you're
nothing to them.
You're talking about like a game of Monopoly, right? Well,
correct.
You're collecting the hotels.
Yes, they're just waiting it out. That is the big play. That is the big money that they're looking for. They're not doing this for your health or mine, to be honest.
Is it going to be like the alcohol business, do you think?
I think it is strongly resembling that. I also think that there are undertones of big tobacco, where you have companies that are maybe cutting corners on actual health impact issues, the truth of what's going on behind their doors. It's just very opaque. And you don't have a lot of people filing public records requests to find out who really makes up these businesses at the end of the day. The good news is, though, our regulators have been here before. They've dealt with other industry. We can learn from big pharma, big tobacco, big alcohol over what we do and don't want out of public policy and health and safety.
Asia, does this frighten you in any way?
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. I was sitting here like, wow. Like,
really?
I mean, it makes a ton of sense, though. And thank you so much. Like, this is super informative. I've learned so much today. It's surreal. I mean, it's a reality of things.
Well, we've just lost a licensed dealer now, so...
No, let's not say that.
I hope not, anyway.
No.
But it does seem like it's quite a mountain to climb.
Yeah, but it's been a mountain to climb. So as long as you're ready for the ride, you know, what can you say? What can you do?
Are you ready for the ride?
I'm definitely... That's why I got my boot on.
Brett, she's wearing a boot. For the radio audience, she obviously had a spill or... Yeah. Are you okay?
I'm fine. Good. Thank you. Good. I'm here.
Brett, how about you? Now, you've been, this isn't your first rodeo, obviously. Brodeo, right?
Yeah. I feel very confident in what I do. I've been honing my craft for a long time. It's why my brand is successful in this marketplace today and why we're excelling in this marketplace whenever the people are failing. I don't outsource any product from anywhere. We grow everything ourselves in-house. We've been doing breeding and selection phenotypes for very specific genetics for a long time to build a very strong menu of an offering to give to people. We do very special collaborations with artists and with fashion, food, music. We try and touch all aspects of life and culture to blend these things together. Thank you, Abdullah. Thank you.
Good testimonial right there. Yeah, huh? No, 5 stars.
But the future of cannabis, though, really is only going to be about the people that have true vision and insight to what is going to work. It's not going to be all these guys that came from big tobacco or alcohol. They don't have the insight that they need to survive to do this. They don't understand how to be scrappy in this space. They know how to throw a lot of money at things. They know how to hire big executive staffs that take up huge bonuses and things that this space can't afford at all. But just, it's like anything else that's successful. You have to do one thing very good and deliver that to the marketplace consistently so that they can get enough of it to realize that what you're doing is good and consistent. The biggest problem for every brand out there that doesn't grow their own cannabis is the wild variations of where they go to source all their cannabis from and the inconsistent in quality that when the consumer comes to buy it, they're like, it was this last time, now it's completely different. Who wants that?
Are you concerned that a big corporation is going to come and gobble you up?
No, I'm not concerned. I've built my model for my business. I've had a lot of time to dream about a legal cannabis space and understanding how to maneuver through this space. I plan on, you know, I'll be kind of egotistical in this moment, but I plan to be a Coca-Cola in this space. I'm building something that is taking me so much energy. You know, part of my team, people have been on my team for 15, 20 years working with me. We are trying to build a real foundation for something that is what the standard of cannabis should be in this space. And we're here to stay. I'm going to do this till I die trying.
Has the sliced bread company come after you? I have to ask you that. Wonder Bread.
No, they haven't yet.
Are you waiting for that knock on the door?
You know, it's possibility that they could come say that, but you know, my name is Brett. So it's like they can't change that. My mom gave me that name. You know, and it's, if they want to come take it, I think it'll be bad for them. Just it'll look dumb on their part, you know.
People have looked worse.
Yeah, I'm sure.
For
you know,
much less.
And what if that's the case, I'll shift and it'll just be whatever the name is. But people will still know that we deliver a quality product, that you don't have to smell it every time and inspect it every time, that you can trust it. It's not like when you build a real brand is something that has consistency that you don't have to question every single time. When you go into the liquor store and you see Patron on the aisle, you don't walk down the aisle and pop the bottle open and smell it to see if it's a good bottle of Patron. You know that you have confidence and faith in that because they've delivered over and over and over again. And that's why my brand excels in this space right now, because we do everything in-house and we put a lot of meticulous detail into everything we do because I want to deliver a promise of a very good experience with my product and all the things that it touches along the way.
Hillary, what Brett is saying, I mean, George Clooney got out of the tequila business, right?
Yeah, commodities are hard, but here's the thing.
Is he being naive?
I'm not sure, because in these markets, some of these companies will survive to compete. I do think that would be very hard to turn down a very nice package from a much larger company, but you can make that decision. A lot of people that will have leverage when this all flips, because it will flip eventually. I cannot tell you when, but it is inevitable at the federal level. They're going to be looking for two things, these big buyers. They're going to be looking for real estate, turnkey farms, because they don't have that on order, and they're going to keep the farmers that know what they're doing, because if it's not broke, don't fix it. And they're going to look for brands. They are going to look for that intellectual property, because that is where the money is at, and it can move like lightning across states once it's federal.
You said it's going to flip. So pot will be legal federally at some point soon?
I wouldn't say soon. I don't think that this presidential administration cares about this issue at all, one way or the other. And the current U.S. Attorney General went on record when he was testifying to get the gig that he would treat this just like we treated it back in 2013 under our original enforcement priorities. Each U.S. attorney, and there are four in the state of California, they haven't done anything. They do not seem interested in this. There are bigger fish to fry, like immigration, other law enforcement issues, international issues. So this is not high on the totem. I do think eventually it's going to be legalized. I think it's going to look a ton like alcohol with a patchwork quilt from state to state, and certain states are always going to be dry. If anybody in here in 20 years can openly buy a joint in a dispensary in Indiana, I will be dead. It is just a legal impossibility, as opposed to other states where it's going to be 24/7. I think of Nevada.
One of the first stories I did for NPR was an Oktoberfest in Cullman, Alabama.
Ugh.
Which is a dry county, by the way. They did an Oktoberfest with cider.
You know, it's a cultural thing. Get it. But we're headed for that. I feel that very strongly.
Yeah. Abdullah, do you think the same thing? Do you think it federally it will be legal at some point? And, I mean, what about the future of cannabis?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty hard to say. I think that there's elements of this current surge in legalization of like the last decade or so that are kind of surprising in some ways. I mean, you know, look, there was a very, very strong anti-cannabis propaganda campaign that went on for decades and decades, right? And it began with Henry Anslinger, and I mean, it continued through Nixon and Reagan, and I mean, even Clinton in some respects, right?
He didn't inhale, though.
Yeah, apparently not.
Yeah. But, does anybody remember that? Yeah, they remember. All right.
But yeah, I mean, I think that we've seen a lot of unexpected things happen, but also I think we're just coming to a time where there's so much information available that, you know, if somebody told you a bunch of bad information about just about anything, you know, now's the time when you can kind of take the truth into your own hands. So, you know, I think people are generally more aware. I think people are more individualistic in the opinions they hold. And I think that leads to a world where people want to look at the facts, right? Where, you know, cannabis still hasn't killed anybody. And I think that at some point, just generationally, there's going to be someone in the White House who is of this mind, you know, who's going to say, okay, you know what? It's just ridiculous that this thing is illegal.
Or
right?
Will campaign in this mind, right?
Yeah, perhaps. I mean
somebody
hopefully.
That could be elected with this as an issue.
I hope very soon. I'm thinking of a guy, you know.
A guy. One guy?
Birdie.
Yeah,
go Birdie.
Definitely. But generally speaking, I think we are definitely headed towards a federal change on that issue. Yeah.
I think we're going to wrap it up there. That's it for us in our special town hall event on Greater LA. Take me to your dealer at KCRW Joint. Thank you, our audience. Give yourselves a round of applause. I want to thank our great panel, attorney Hillary Bricken, pot entrepreneurs Khadijah Allen and Brett Feldman of Wonder Bread, and our Greater LA pot contributor Abdullah Saeed. We're online at kcrw.com/GreaterLA. Thank you to our studio audience here in our performance studio, the Annenberg Performance Studio at KCRW headquarters. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your ears and for your eyes today. Have a great day.